So welcome, everyone. Welcome to this evening of meditation and Dharma. I'm Linda Graham, and thank you for welcoming me to this Sangha that I know is steeped in deep Dharma practice. It's really a privilege to be here. I need to ask if people can hear me in the back. Do I need to speak up more, or are we okay for now? It's okay? I want to share with you a quote from Helen Keller. All the world is full of suffering. It is also full of overcoming. James used that quote in his book, Awakening Joy, and I used it in my book, Bouncing Back. And we come to our practice in the light of the Buddha's teachings. I have come to teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. So I want to explore suffering tonight through the lens of response flexibility, that we're actually able to meet and cope with and move through the suffering that we're heir to in the human condition with some flexibility and adaptability and resilience. So I've been a psychotherapist for 20 years, and the heart of clinical practice is to provide tools and practices to clients to help them face stress and trauma and adversity with some sense of resilience and flexibility, that we're able to cope with the challenges and crises of life, with the disappointments and disasters of life, with some skill and some grace. I've been practicing Vipassana meditation for 16 years now, teaching it for the last five. And at the heart of our path is the practice of equanimity, which allows us to come to a sense of calm and centeredness and groundedness so that we can have clarity and insight and compassion and acceptance and discernment and wise choices about how to meet the suffering that we face in our lives. James and I, for the last 5 years, have been part of a group called NeuroDharma. It meets monthly. And it's people who are interested in the intersection of contemplative practice and neuroscience and modern psychology. So I'll be giving a neurodharma kind of talk at the day-long at Spirit Rock on the 16th and exploring how mindfulness and compassion can be practices that are very powerful to help us rewire our brains so that we can become more resilient and actually reduce or alleviate our suffering. I've been studying neuroscience for about 12 years, particularly the field called interpersonal neurobiology, which is a study of how the brain develops in interaction with other brains, personal-to-personal development of the brain. The field of neuroscience is actually very new. The technology that allows scientists to peek inside the black box of the brain as the brain is responding to real events in real time is only 20 years old. That's only one generation of research. And so as the neuroscientists are finding out what happens in the brain as we have an argument with our spouse, or we watch the evening news, or we mourn the loss of a pet, they're discovering two things that are very important for our alleviating our suffering. One is that the capacities for resilience and coping with suffering are innate in the brain. They are hardwired in by evolution. We all have those capacities. And that those capacities are developed by experience, that the brain learns from experience. So by now, you may know this drill already, that any experience at all, positive or negative, will cause neurons in the brain to fire. Repeated experiences, repeated neural firing. Neurons that fire together many times will wire together. So that as we choose experiences, if we focus our attention and set an intention and cultivate practices like mindfulness and compassion and gratitude and equanimity, we're actually causing the neurons in the brain to strengthen their connections with each other and create new neural circuits and pathways and create the brain structure that will support those practices. Now, there's a lot that neuroscientists don't know yet about the brain. They have no clue whatsoever how the physical neural substrate of the brain creates the operations of the mind, or how neural firing can create consciousness. They have no idea. So science bows to the mystery, and it may be a long time before they understand that. But the greatest discovery of neuroscience so far is the discovery of neuroplasticity, that the brain can grow new neurons and create new connections among those neurons and rewire our patterns of response and reorganize its own functioning lifelong. We can now take for granted that we know about neuroplasticity, but up until 15 years ago, neuroscientists were staunchly convinced that once the brain developed, it was fixed, that it didn't change or grow beyond that point. You can't teach an old dog new tricks kind of thinking. But neuroplasticity is creating a massive paradigm shift in neuroscience, and that's contributing to a paradigm shift in how we come to practice. That when we can choose experiences that will strengthen our mindfulness, our compassion, our gratitude, our equanimity, we're actually harnessing the self-directed neuroplasticity of the brain, and we're actually using those practices to create new neural structure so that we can set our intention and cultivate practices that will actually help us become more flexible, more resilient, and reduce our suffering. So how do we do that, and how do we do that in a Buddhist framework? So tonight I'm going to talk about compassion and then mindfulness and then lead you in an exercise that will use both compassion and mindfulness to rewire a particularly difficult form of human suffering. And then we'll have a Q&A. So I'm beginning with compassion and empathy and loving kindness because the development of the human brain begins with compassion and empathy and loving kindness. Early on, as we experience an empathic, attuned, compassionate, tender, caregiving and comforting and soothing, that actually kindles the development of the brain, and it shapes the maturation of the prefrontal cortex, which is the most important structure of the brain for resilience. Conscious awareness comes later. And I will talk about mindfulness. I'll talk about two practices of mindfulness. But we're beginning with compassion because when we have the experiences early on or later in life of compassion, kindness, empathy, we're developing the structure of the prefrontal cortex right here in the brain. It becomes the executive center of our functioning. It becomes what allows us to have intention and motivation and make plans and make decisions. But it is also what allows us to be resilient in our relationships with others and in responding to life. So I'm going to just briefly go over some of the functions of this prefrontal cortex. You'll see why I call it the CEO of resilience. It allows us to regulate our body and our nervous system, which means when we start to get revved up with some anxiety or some anger, or if we start to fall apart and collapse down, it's the prefrontal cortex that brings us back into a physiological equilibrium that is the basis of our equanimity. The prefrontal cortex quells the fear response of the amygdala. That's actually pretty important when we're trying to deal with suffering. It manages all of our emotions so that we can stay not flooded and not shut down, but in a calm, centered place with our emotions so that we can come into clarity and out of confusion and overwhelm into clarity and insight and see clearly what's happening and our reactions to what's happening. It is also the structure that we use for attunement, which allows us to know what's going on in our own body, our own emotions, as well as what's going on in someone else's body and their emotions. It's the basis of empathy, where we can make sense of our experience. We can make sense of the story. Oh, I understand. Of course that's what would happen. Of course that's what you would do. It's perfectly understandable, which is opening up to compassion. It's the structure we use for insight and self-awareness, and it's the structure of response flexibility, which allows us to see different perspectives and options and shift gears. So we want to strengthen the development of the prefrontal cortex. And how do we do that now in our Buddhist practice? So many of you may have been here when Kristin Neff talked about mindful self-compassion, or you've read her book on self-compassion. Self-compassion basically is the idea that we can get comfort and support and encouragement from other people when we're facing some suffering. But very often we're in a moment of acute suffering and there's no one else around. And we need to be able to very mindfully and quickly offer ourselves a sense of care and compassion so that we can come back into that regulated center of calm and begin to cope with whatever's going on. So mindful self-compassion is simply noticing, ouch, this hurts, and offering to ourselves a sense of care and tenderness and comfort. This is a moment of suffering. This is part of the pain of being a human being. And I can keep my mind and heart open to my own experience, to my experience as a sufferer in this moment. And that allows us to come out of any overwhelm or confusion back into a kind of clarity where we can be mindful and begin to figure out the next step. There's a very simple practice that we can use that brings us into a sense of self-compassion in less than a minute. So I'm going to lead you through it, and then I'll just talk briefly about the neuroscience that explains why this works so well to bring us back into a sense of equilibrium or equanimity. So I'm going to teach it as hand on the heart. I know that James and Tara Brach teach it as hand on the cheek. But there are reasons why. There's reasons in our brain why working with our heart center is more effective. So if you'll simply allow yourself to follow along, you put your own hand on your own heart and feel the warmth of the touch of your hand on your heart center. And then just simply begin to breathe deeply and gently into your heart center. And if you wish, you can breathe a sense of ease or safety or peacefulness into your heart center. And then take a moment to remember just one single moment when you felt safe and loved and cherished with another human being. It could be your spouse or a good friend or a child. It could be a therapist or a teacher, a spiritual figure like the Buddha or the Dalai Lama. It could be a pet. And as you remember this moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished, just let the warm glow of that feeling seep down into your body. And we'll just linger here for a few seconds. When you're ready, you can open your eyes. So I'll answer questions about that in the Q&A, but what's happening is the warm, safe touch on your heart center activates the release of oxytocin, which is the brain's natural hormone of safety and trust. So you're already beginning to come back into a sense of calm and equilibrium. Breathing deeply activates the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system. It's what allows us to calm down. When you breathe a sense of ease or goodness into your heart center, you restore the heart rate variability coherence. It's also calming down your level of stress. And then when you remember a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished, you're really activating the release of oxytocin, touching someone we love, being with someone we love, but even remembering being with someone we love is enough to activate the release of oxytocin. And it is the hormone of safety and trust, bonding and belonging, calm and connect. So it's the fastest way we have to bring our nervous system back into calm. Oxytocin is the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So when you put your hand on your heart, you can actually calm down a panic attack in less than a minute. So we're learning these practices of compassion and care for ourselves so that we can actually create a safe space to open up our mind and our heart, to then become mindful and aware of what's actually happening and what we might need to do to respond to what's happening. So the first way I'm talking about mindfulness is in a very focused way. It's when we pause and become present. We come out of distraction or denial or dissociation. We just simply show up for the experience of the moment. And then we notice and name it. And I know we're trained in our meditation practice to note our experience and then gently let it go. But it's very important when we notice and name our experience, we're actually keeping the functioning of the higher brain online. And we're also breaking the automaticity of the automatic reactive patterns of the lower brain. So when we take a moment to notice and name our experience, we're already helping our brain become more resilient to cope with it. Then we monitor and modify our experience. So we notice what's going on, and we can skillfully modify it. We can discern, is this wholesome or unwholesome? Is this working or not working? Is this skillful or not skillful? Is what I'm doing have integrity? Is it aligned with my moral compass? Is it aligned with my true nature? So we begin to pay attention, monitoring and modifying so that we can shift our experience if we need to. And we can shift to a wiser view, to a different perspective, and then we can begin to discern options and make some wise choices. So I have a story to tell on myself about that. I tell the story in the book. It's a true story. I was walking to work one day. I park my car in Golden Gate Park and walk a couple of blocks to my office. And I do that on automatic pilot. So I wasn't paying attention to where I was going. I was worried about something, and so I was up in my head tossing my ideas around, and I didn't notice, and I walked into a sidewalk of freshly laid cement up to my ankles. And the cascade starts. How could you be so asleep at the wheel? Look at what you've done. How could you be so clumsy? And I noticed that, and I decided I was really kind of sick and tired of beating myself up just because I wasn't paying attention and I made a mistake. So I picked my feet up, and then I picked my shoes up. And there was an apartment building there with an outdoor faucet, so I began to wash off my shoes. And I realized, so what? I made a mistake. I'm not the only person on the planet that made a mistake today because they weren't paying attention. This is probably not the only mistake I'm going to make today. So can I shift? Can I change my attitude about this somehow instead of going down the same old rabbit hole of criticizing myself? So by now the construction workers are coming over with their paper towels and they're helping me dry off my shoes, and I kind of begin to get it. Yes, shit happens. But shift happens too. And I can choose to shift my attitude, my perspective in this moment. I can have a completely different response to this event. And then I realized I could shift my attitude in any moment. So we learn these lessons when we're mindful and paying attention to what's going on in our head, that we can shift our attitude and make a wiser choice. Now that form of mindfulness is when the brain is in a focused mode of processing. We're paying attention, we're focused on what we're doing or what we're thinking. There's a second mode of processing in the brain. It's a defocused mode of processing, and they're both actually pretty essential to self-directed neuroplasticity and being more resilient and reducing our suffering. So when the neuroscientists began mapping in the brain what happens when the brain is responding to a real event in real time, they would put people in their fMRI scanners, or they would put electrodes all over their scalp and plug them into an EEG machine, and they would record what structures of the brain light up when the brain is doing what. And so they would ask people to identify shapes or solve a puzzle, and they would see what was going on in the brain. They assumed that when the brain wasn't focused on a task, when it wasn't being asked to do something, that it would be quiet, that it would be inactive. And about a decade ago, Marcus Wakely discovered that it's the exact opposite. When the brain is not focused on a task, it is active all over the brain. It's very noisy. It's now called the default network. So this is the mode of defocused processing in the brain that we access when we practice choiceless awareness. When we loosen the grip of our focus on something, we're not focusing on the breath or on a phrase or on an image. We're just letting the awareness of the brain expand out to a more spacious awareness. And then sometimes we can just fall into a sense of being. We fall into a sense of, oh, nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. We can sometimes very spontaneously experience a sense of oneness with all of existence. We can experience a sense of our own true nature or our own Buddha nature. Now, the neuroscientists call this mode of processing the plane of open possibilities or a mental play space, because they now think this is the mode of processing that gives rise to epiphanies and insights and revelations. Because the brain, when it's not focused on doing something specific, is kind of looking around for something to play with. And it's making its own associations and links and connecting the dots on its own. We're not guiding that or controlling that. But sometimes we have the experience, something just pops into our awareness out of the blue. Oh, I never thought of that. And so that's something coming from that defocused mode of processing in the brain. So my story about that is I was on a long retreat at Spirit Rock. So I was fairly focused and fairly concentrated. And I go into the dining hall and I notice that they've run out of broccoli. And I go into a little snip in my mind because they've run out of broccoli. And I'm mindful enough to notice that, okay, my mind is doing this about the broccoli, and I can let that go. A couple of hours later, I'm doing a walking meditation out in the courtyard where you can overlook the hills. And there's a tree, and there's a leaf fluttering on the tree. And you know how this happens sometimes. Phew! Right out to oneness with all of existence. Just this blissful, peaceful state that I get to hang out in about 20 minutes. And then finally I realize, oh, that was a very pleasant state of mind. And my broccoli snit wasn't so pleasant. But they are both states of mind that come and go. And then my job was to just to fall back into the awareness that can hold these states of mind coming and going. And so when we have experiences or insights like that, it carries a tremendous sense of truth sense, truth force. It's the prefrontal cortex that allows us to toggle back and forth between this focused mode of processing, task-oriented, it's actually called the self-referential network in the literature, and the defocused mode of processing, or the non-self network. And we can go back and forth and use the insights that we've gained from the defocused mode of processing to inform and transform our sense of personal self and how we cope. So the poet Walt Whitman said, I'm larger than I thought. I didn't know I held so much goodness. Or the Indian sage Sri Nisargadatta, who said, love teaches me I'm everything. Wisdom teaches me I'm nothing. Between the two, my life flows. So I want to... Oh, I have one caveat about this defocused mode of processing. And you may have noticed this in your own meditation. When we're not focused on something, a task or the breath or an image, and the brain is just kind of playing around, if a worry or an anxiety pops up in our mind, the brain can just latch onto that and begin to ruminate and obsess about that. It just chews on it for hours. And you may have had that experience in your own meditation. So it's very helpful when we do our own practices to clear worry and stress and anxiety and trauma, so that when we open up our minds to a kind of choiceless awareness, it's just an easy resting in awareness. We don't fall into that ruminating. And similarly, sometimes when people drop into a sense of beingness or emptiness, they can drop into what feels like a void. and rather than the fullness of emptiness coming into form and falling away again. So it's important in our practice that we're also ardent and diligent and resolute and mindful about clearing out previous stresses or traumas that we may be carrying in our implicit memory. We're building a kind of stability in the brain so that when we relax into that more spacious awareness, we actually can stay steady in the sense of emptiness that can feel quite peaceful. So I want to offer a practice that will combine mindfulness, bringing experience to conscious awareness, and compassion, holding that experience in a kind of tenderness and caring, with a neural mechanism that I'll explain in a minute called memory deconsolidation and reconsolidation, to be able to shift or rewire a particular form of suffering. I just realized I completely forgot to say something, so I'm going to go back and say it. When I'm talking about neuroscience and how we can work with our own neuroplasticity, the whole paradigm shift can be summarized by the thinking of two people in the neurodharma world. One is Paul Gilbert, who's a colleague of mine and James's. He's a psychologist in the UK. He wrote the book Compassionate Mind. And his model is that given our evolutionary legacy, we've had 200 million years of developing the human brain. So the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain and the primate brain, we're never going to not have that. That's our evolutionary inheritance. And given the genetic loading, each cell in our brain contains the entire human genome. But when we're born and come into human form, there's a particular genetic expression that is us, and that's an imprint. Given our family of origin conditioning, that the experiences we have early on shape our patterns of response, they get encoded in our implicit memory by the time we're 18 months of age, they shape the development of the brain itself. And given the norms and expectations of our culture and our society, the historic age we were born into, the race or gender we were born into, given all of that, the 10,000 causes upstream, who we are and how we cope is not our fault. But given neuroplasticity and that we can choose experiences that will rewire the brain, given self-directed neuroplasticity, who we are and how we cope is our responsibility. And I'd wanted to quote Richard Davidson, who runs one of the major neuroimaging labs in the country, University of Wisconsin at Madison. He's a friend of James's also. And his lab has compiled most of the data that shows what powerful practices mindfulness and compassion are to change neural structure. They are two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to science. And so he says, based upon everything we know about the brain and neuroscience, change is not only possible, but is actually the rule rather than the exception. It's really just a question of which influences we're going to choose for our brain. The brain is shaped by experience, and because we have a choice about what experiences we want to use to shape our brain, we have a responsibility to choose the experiences that will shape the brain toward the wise and the wholesome. So I went back to pick that up because now I'm actually going to ask you to choose, to use experiences that I will guide you in a guided meditation to actually begin to rewire your brain toward the wise and the wholesome. So what we're going to focus on is a particular form of human suffering called shame. And shame is the biggest derailer of our resilience. So some of you by now may have heard Brené Brown's TED Talks on shame and vulnerability and shame resilience. She's a psychologist and researcher at the University of Houston, and she has spent many years researching shame. And she says, shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. Because shame creates feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection, shame erodes the part of ourselves that believes we are capable of change. We cannot change and grow when we are in shame, and we can't use shame to change ourselves or others. So I'm wanting to use the practices of mindfulness and compassion and this particular technique of brain change to help us rewire the schemas of shame. It's a powerful experience when we learn that we can do that. So the mechanism is called deconsolidation, reconsolidation, and the neuroscientists discovered it just 5 to 7 years ago. That doesn't mean it hasn't been happening in our brain all this time, but they now can see in the scanners the mechanism in action. So what it means is when neurons are firing together and they're creating a network that holds together or constellates a memory of an experience, we can cause that network of memory to fall apart and then rewire. And what causes it to fall apart and rewire is juxtaposing something that directly disconfirms or contradicts it. And that juxtaposition causes the neurons to fall apart, and then they will rewire again a few seconds later, but differently. So when we're working with a schema or a belief or a memory of shame, and if we can juxtapose against that feeling a sense of our own goodness, our own true nature, our own Buddha nature, that juxtaposition will cause the neurons holding that memory of shame to fall apart. And when we hold that sense of goodness or our true nature, it will cause the neurons to rewire again differently. So when you've had an experience of responding to people or a life event or a stressor by feeling inadequate or not good enough or a failure or not worthy or not lovable, that's the experience that I'm talking about. And we can use our sense of goodness or true nature to rewire that. Tara Brach calls that feeling of shame the trance of unworthiness. I have another client who calls it our innocent exuberance being slammed mid-pirouette. Shame is an acute form of human suffering. It is sometimes chronic. And so I'm going to lead us in an exercise that I hope will give you an experience of being able to rewire that particular form of suffering. So what we're going to do, I'll describe it first and then I'll lead you in it as sort of a guided meditation. Remembering a memory of an interaction with another person that went awry didn't go so well. And you can feel the pain or the sting or the hurt of that still. You're here in this room with mindfulness and compassion for yourself. You're safe here and now as you're remembering something that happened back there and then. But you're lighting up the networks of that memory and remembering an interaction that maybe still causes you a little pain. And then what I'm going to ask you to do is, from your awareness of your wiser self or your true nature, begin to imagine a different outcome to that interaction, a different wished-for scenario. It does not matter to the brain if that could have ever happened in real life. You're using your imagination to create a new experience juxtaposed to the old experience that will cause the neurons of the old experience to fall apart and rewire. We can do this practice over time and create incremental changes, but sometimes it actually happens in a quantum shift. It can be instant. And it can be permanent. So what we're doing is not simply a cognitive override. It is not trading one belief for another belief. It's not replacing a negative thought with a positive affirmation. It is actually lighting up the network of the original memory and causing it to fall apart and rewire so that it rewires into a different pattern. It's a more holistic change from the bottom up. It's body sensations and emotions and thoughts and feelings and beliefs. It's more holistic. It is the neural underpinning of all change in therapy and all change that happens on and off the cushion. So if you're comfortable doing this exercise, I'll lead you in it, and then we'll have a Q&A afterwards. If you're not in your comfort zone, then simply sit and listen and observe and take notes if you wish. But if you actually follow the guided meditation, you may actually experience a shift in your brain or in your thoughts about yourself. So we begin simply, you can close your eyes if you wish, that's sometimes easier to do the guided meditation. Anchor yourself in a sense of your own goodness, your own worthiness, your own lovability, knowing that from experiencing your true nature, or even remembering that moment earlier of feeling safe and loved and cherished. Really let yourself have a sense of safety and well-being. And then into that safe container, remember one moment, one interaction between you and another person that didn't go so well. And there may still be a sense of hurt or pain or shame about it. And stay mindful and compassionate toward yourself as you remember what you said, what they said, what you did or didn't do, what they did or didn't do. Remember where you were, who else was around, how old you were, and see if you can let arise in your body the feeling sense of that memory. Be tender and caring of yourself. You just let yourself remember what that feels like. And then when you're ready, begin to imagine a different way this whole interaction could have gone. You said something different, or they said something different, and it does not matter if that ever could have happened in real life. It's your imagination, you're creating the new experience. You say or do something differently, they say or do something differently. Someone who wasn't even there at the time comes into the scene and helps you out and does something differently. And let yourself create this new scenario, this wish-for outcome, until you come to a sense of resolution, a sense of ease and satisfaction about it. And let yourself feel and savor what this new outcome feels like in your body. Body sensations, emotions, thoughts you might have about yourself. Notice the shifts in this new outcome. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. And I'll say just a couple of things and then we'll open it up for the Q&A. This practice of juxtaposing an old negative or traumatizing memory with a new sense of ourselves, a new experience of ourselves that is more positive, it's stronger, more in line with our true nature, does not rewrite history, but it does rewire the brain. And it doesn't change what happened, but it changes our relationship to what happened. And our relationship to ourselves now as we remember what happened. So this is a way of using a mindfulness practice and a compassion practice, knowing how this mechanism of deconsolidation, reconsolidation works, to create a new scenario, to create a new neural circuit or new pathway in our brain, so that we can become more resilient, more flexible in our responses, and move toward alleviating or even ending our suffering. So now I do want to open it up to questions. And someone will pass around the mic so that it gets caught on the recording. Any comments or reflections? What are you noticing?
I just find everything you're saying completely fascinating. And I love it because, for instance, you say put your hand on your heart and all these things happen. And I know I put my hand on my heart and I feel better. But it's so supportive to know that there's actually all this stuff going on in my body that it's really, really happening. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it easier to keep doing these things.
Exactly.
And sort of believe in it slowly because I know it's actually going on. So it's great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's important about any of these practices is that we begin to develop, I mean, not only learning how the brain works, but we begin to develop a sense of mastery or a sense of competence that we actually can make a change in the direction we want the brain to go. And once we experience that we can do that, even once, we know that we can do that. And so it is very encouraging then to keep going and keep going. It's a great aid to practice. Other questions or comments? Yes, please.
I'm just curious about shame, mm-hmm. and if there's a positive place in interactions with people as children for that emotion.
You know, I used to believe and taught that there was healthy shame and toxic shame, and that healthy shame is where we learn to observe the norms of our culture, of our tribe, so that we get to belong and we're not exiled. Because exile is really death to the psyche. But I've become convinced, partly through Brené Brown's research and other people as well, that all shame is toxic. It's a smallifying of the self. It causes a person to kind of hide and disconnect. And that makes us unavailable to the resources that we could use for comfort or for learning or for growth. So now many people in the field consider anxiety and shame to be the two pathogenic affects. They are what cause defenses. And when we have defenses, the brain is blocked from learning, and then it can't change its patterns. So we try to do things to come out of shame into acceptance, into just allowing enough for the brain to do its learning. So I think that's now why parents are talking about, I need to talk to you about your behavior, but I love you. I'll correct the behavior, but I'm not going to shame you. Right. It's to say, let's talk about your behavior. You can't do this behavior. There's a big difference between shame and guilt, because guilt is over something we've done, and we can make amends for that. There's healthy remorse, and we can change our behavior. But shame, we wind up feeling that we're bad. Not that we did something bad, that we're bad. And that becomes toxic to the psyche, to the sense of self. So it's really important to come out of shame into a sense of love and acceptance. And then we can do the learning to change our behavior. There's something here. Yes?
I wonder if there's been... Is that working? Oh. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's been any research on working with rewriting traumatic events. So you talked about, you know, living an event, but changing it.
Yes. So I'm trained in some of the trauma modalities these days, EMDR and sensory motor. And so the thinking now is that all trauma is held in the body. Memories of trauma are held in the body, and they may not even come to conscious awareness. But if we can find ways to help the body move in ways that it couldn't at the time of the trauma. It couldn't protect or it couldn't run away. That was not safe. It couldn't stand up for itself. It would get whacked. If we can allow the body now to move in the ways that weren't available then, that does the rewiring. From the bottom up, the body will rewire the brain. And it begins to change those memories or our relationship to those memories. So yeah, trauma therapy these days is very powerful. And there's no question it can rewire the brain. Thank you.
Speaking about for a moment, I'm recovering from an electrocution happened 50 years ago. And high voltage, low voltage. And 4 years going through the process like you described. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful trauma that your body experienced.
Yeah. Right. And it did cause human neurons to fire all over in sequence in a wild cavity in the body.
I can believe that. And I can appreciate the perseverance that it takes to do that recovery and to do that rewiring.
Yeah, and the living with me.
Mm-hmm. That points to something that I could say about this whole process of neuroplasticity and choosing experiences that will rewire the brain to build our resilience and relieve our suffering. Probably one of the most important is perseverance, because the brain learns by repetition. We have experience, we repeat the experience, the neurons fire, they strengthen their connections. So anything that we repeat is strengthening the brain structure. So it's more important to do something little and often than necessarily to do something big and dramatic, because it's the repetition, it's the perseverance that in the long run rewires the brain, which is why we practice and practice and practice. Other questions or comments? Please.
I'm not exactly sure how to articulate this, but I'm just sitting here wondering, I totally agree with what you say about how debilitating shame is, mm-hmm. for me anyway, but I just wonder how this talk would go in an audience of mostly Asian people. And I'm asking that because, interestingly, I'm reading this book right now by Orville Schell, you know, the mm-hmm. China expert, and he wrote this book, Wealth and Power, and just started reading it, and one of his theses is that what has motivated China, you know, to become, you know, a world-class power now is a lot of shame and humiliation that it experienced in the middle of the 19th century, especially starting then when, you know, Western countries invaded and carved up China. And so it's fascinating to me that I'm reading this book and it's all about shame and humiliation and the motivating factors of shame and humiliation. And here you are talking about how, although I agree with you, you know, how totally debilitating it is.
Mm-hmm. So,
because I also thought about, you know, Erickson, but that's such a Western view, you know, shame, autonomy versus shame and doubt. I'm just curious about your thoughts about this.
So I wish I could pull together more of the research that's being done right now. We're having to change our view about a lot of things around motivation. We've been taught that self-esteem, the urge for self-esteem, is a great motivator, and yet Kristen Neff has discovered in her research that self-compassion is a greater motivator than self-esteem. Because self-esteem works when we're succeeding, and self-compassion works at any moment at all, including the moments when we're falling apart. There's research coming out of Stanford about willpower versus a kind of willingness and surrender or allowing. And they're finding that when people try to do something out of willpower and setting an intention that they will accomplish something, it sets them up for performance and failure. Whereas when people set an intention, may I do something, I'm willing to do something, it just sets them up for their own effort, but not performance and failure. So that people are more likely to meet their goals out of a sense of willingness rather than willpower. When it comes to shame and humiliation, it really, I mean, we also have the experience of Germany being shamed and humiliated after World War I. And the motivations and ambitions that that led to were pretty catastrophic for the world. So I think we can rely more on the power of love, loving kindness, acceptance, compassion. Those are more motivating in the long run than trying to recover or restore the ego from an experience of shame and humiliation. But I think we need a lot more research about that. But it's an excellent question. Thank you. Yes, please.
I had heard about like a brain process or a chemical reaction that when you have a contact with a cat or something. And personally, I had a period that was like kind of a crisis, and acute anxiety, insomnia, and the only thing that would usually work would be like kind of had my dog. And someone told me about like chemical reactions, brain reactions, and stuff. And I never heard about that.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about with the oxytocin. The warm, safe touch, and sometimes pets are better than people because they're less judgmental. The warm, safe touch, oxytocin is released through making love, through childbirth, through breastfeeding, but it's also any safe, warm touch anywhere on the body. So a head massage, rubbing the back of the brainstem, which is loaded with oxytocin receptors, is good. A hug. Stan Takin at UCLA found that a 20-second full-body hug, not the A-frame, but the full-body hug, is enough to release oxytocin in the brain. That's 3 breaths. If you hug someone for 3 breaths. So cuddling or snuggling with a dog will release the oxytocin as well. It's all about love and belonging. So, yeah, have a good time with your dog. Other comments or questions, please? Mm-hmm. Wait for the mic.
Be a living being? What about a stuffed animal?
If you can use your imagination with your stuffed animal, imagination is... the neuroscientists have found that imagination, guided imagery, visualization, is as powerful to the brain as seeing something in real life. When we imagine a banana, the same neurons fire in the visual cortex as when we're seeing a real banana. So that's the power of guided imagery and guided visualization. So if you can create an in your imagination a relationship with a stuffed animal where the like practicing loving kindness or metta for your stuffed animal, you're getting the feeling going in your own body. That's just fine. It's a way to release the oxytocin in your own brain. Yeah. Which is maybe how kids do it. Other questions or comments, please? When do we end? Okay, a few more minutes. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had just a comment on the visualization.
Okay.
When I was a child, about 5, I was with a really abusive babysitter, but I had to take 3-hour naps. But I remember to get through the period because I could not leave, and you didn't leave with this person, was that I had this imagination. I would, you know, just with the covers, just like I had a ski resort and people skiing down my knees and things flying through the air. And then maybe I'd hear it outside the door and I would just pretend to be asleep. And then I'd listen for her to go away and I'd just go back into this little world again.
Mm-hmm.
It helped me enormously. So, I mean, and then, you know, it did get me through can say that was really a crazy trauma.
So we can distinguish between when something traumatizing is going on, the brain has a very powerful protective mechanism of dissociation. Check out. You're not there. And that's how people can survive severe trauma. We can come close to that when we go into daydream or reverie because what's happening is boring or what's happening is just not what we want to be doing. And they're a similar process in the brain. But we do try to stay connected. We know where we are and we know why we're doing it. And then it's a very useful mechanism to survive. Other comments? Or so then, if there's no more comments or questions, we just sit quietly. I would have a different way of closing the meditation. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. May our sincere practices of mindfulness and compassion lead to the end of suffering for ourselves and all beings. May all beings be safe from inner and outer harm. May all beings be free of suffering and from all causes of suffering. And from causing any suffering. Blessings on your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.